Welcome to Beano Jeff Henderson's hour of our relaunch here. My main man, the great Beano Jeff Henderson. You're going to get to know him up close and personally here. That is my aim with what we're about to do. Whether we succeed or not remains to be seen. But Beano, first of all, if you can, and thanks for doing this. Thanks for opening yourself up and talking about yourself a little bit, because generally you're not a guy that's self-promoting, just as I'm not. But somebody had suggested that we do this, Beano, and let people, the new folks, and even folks who have listened to us for years that don't know truly who we are, kind of a look-see into who we are, how we came to sports, how we came to the Tennessee experience, thus what unites us. Let's back up, Beano. And if you can, before we get into your life, share with me how you came to find me. And I'm just curious as to what your reaction was the first time you heard this or heard me.
Tony, I was a I was a latecomer as a caller, but I had loved sports talk radio for as long as I could remember, from Pete Franklin in the early 70s on 3WE. That was my introduction to sports talk. There wasn't really any on the radio in this area. But I had been a sports talk junkie for a long time. And I found you, once it came into the market, when I had opportunity, I would always look for it. I worked at Y-12, so I was kind of closed out during the week. I couldn't listen, but I would listen on the weekends and I would listen on the drive home. So I think I initially found you on Joy 62. The first time I really remember your show, though, was a Saturday morning. You were doing a Saturday morning show, and it was before Brian Beam, but you had a straight guy with you, a guy that was more of what you would call a Tennessee guy. And I can remember it was like point counterpoint, and he was kind of pro Tennessee, and you were kind of, well, you're really not looking at this with an open mind. And my first impression was, who is this guy, and what imbecile put him on my radio? I found myself siding with your cohort all the time and against whatever you had to say. But the more I listened to it, the more I liked it, and the more I realized that the product that you were putting out there was true, pure sports conversation. It wasn't, I'm going to throw this bunch of information at you. It wasn't, I'm going to tell you how to think. It was like sitting around with your buddies and having a nice, open conversation.
And so, you know, it's funny that some people, when it comes to me, can't get past that first impression. How were you able to get past that first impression?
I think I continued to give it a chance, Tony, and it was probably like seeing Joe Theismann get his leg broke. You know, it's not something I thought that I enjoyed, but I never could turn away from it. But I just thought I would give things a chance. It was different. It was different than what I was accustomed to. It was more like Pete Franklin. It was more like I was introduced to sports talk rather than, you know, the product which was here, which was fine. But it was more to my taste, and I knew that. And the more I listened, the more I enjoyed it. But and I never thought that I had anything airworthy, Tony. I listened and listened. The first time I ever picked up the phone to call a show was in 1995, and I called you. I'd been listening to sports talk shows since, as I said, the early 70s, but never thought that I should pick up. Never thought I had anything that people would want to listen to. Still amazed people want to, but I picked up the phone and called you in 1995, and I didn't know the process, and I hung up the first time, and they came back to you on the air, and I heard you say, Reno, Casino, Gino, or whoever he know, call back. And so I called back, and I was using the name Beano because that's what I used as a when we would play boards and stuff at the plant. You know, you couldn't put your name on them, of course. And so Beano was a nickname that some of my ex-friends had given me because I was having a whole lot of difficulty in accurately predicting the outcome of sporting events. So I just thought I would use that on the air. You already had a Jeff. You had Jeff from Halls. I thought he was fantastic. I'd been listening to him forever. And I didn't want to be a second Jeff. I didn't want to call as Jeff and people say, oh, God, that's not Jeff. So I just made up my own name.
And the whole Beano thing, why Beano? You told me one time it was because of your prognostication ability.
Yeah, it was.
Was that just apocryphal, or is that real?
Some of my ex-friends had begun to call me Beano because I was having a little trouble accurately predicting the outcome of sporting events. Remember, Beano Cook said Ryan Paulus was going to win the Heisman three or four times, and he picked Tennessee to win the national championship one year for Sports Illustrated, and I think they won about five games that year or some kind of nonsense like that. So it was just a name that I had used when I couldn't use my real name, my Christian name. So I just thought the Tony Basilio Show was a good place to break that out.
So we're visiting with my man Beano, Jeff Beano Henderson, as part of our relaunch here. However you're consuming this, whether you're consuming it as part of our podcast on the website, as we will leave it for folks to learn more about our radio family, or if you're listening to us today on the VLZ 1180 during our hiatus. Beano, let's talk about you. And we talked about how you had found the show, and you had mentioned you were working at the plant. You're an Oak Ridge guy. Share with me some about your family background and how it came to be that you came to be so interested in sports.
Tony, it was my family has all been very sports oriented. My dad was a high school football player, and he had, you know, he was a World War II and Korean War veteran, and he had heart condition and emphysema from the time that I can remember. So he wasn't real active, but he was a huge sports fan. My mother was a high school basketball player. Her brothers, Bud and Jack Pope, are both in the Oak Ridge Football Hall of Fame. Jackie actually signed with the University of Tennessee and played lettered in his sophomore year, and then transferred to Middle Tennessee State and finished out that. They were both Jackie was a college football coach. Buddy was a high school baseball coach and football coach. And my brother Ron was captain of the Oak Ridge High School basketball team and was a scratch golfer. And my brother Mike was a small college caliber high school football player and an excellent baseball player. It's just it's just a sports oriented family. It's what we did.
Your brother Ron, who was also in the military, was a scratch golfer?
Absolutely. He was
at what age?
From high school on, played on the high school
wow.
golf team. You and I were talking about you just recently talking about some of your son's teammates and that could hit it a mile, you know, and although they're not weren't huge guys, Ron's top weight was probably 155 pounds, and he could hit it out of sight.
Now Ron's no longer with us, and what a loss that he is. What a wonderful guy your brother is. One of the things I've noticed about your family, Beano, is that Henderson wit. All three of you guys have that Henderson wit. Where does the Henderson wit come from? And if you can, share some stories about the Henderson wit growing up.
Well, it comes from our dad. And he and my brother Mike, it's this radio family knows as Fab Five Freddy, they're in a different league than I'm in. They're both Fab Five Freddy still, but it came from my dad. And you know, an example that I've always given you was I was 9-10 years old, sitting and watching the Kaz Walker variety show. Kaz Walker had a show that was local talent would come in, you know, and they would perform, and then he would in between acts he would promote his specials. and he had a tripod, and he had a big poster board up there with whatever the specials were. Well, he had a son-in-law. I believe his son-in-law was Greek, and he started letting him do the promo part of things. So he'd be going, Blue Band Coffee, such and such, such and such. And I'm sitting there watching it. Dad was, as I told you, he had emphysema, but he was a – he just hungered for knowledge and read all the time, whatever. He was always sitting there reading and paying about half attention to the television. But he was reading. He had a – always had a toothpick in his mouth. But I'm watching it, and Kaz's son-in-law is going through there, and he comes to one – and it says polyester pants, 2 for $10. Well, he can't pronounce it, so he says polyester pants, 2 for $10. And I turn around to Daddy, and he's reading. I said, Dad, what are polyester pants? And he looked up, looked away from his book and looked up the television. And without a blink, he said, well, son, I tell you, if you buy a pair of pants from Kaz Walker's, you're going to wear them for about a week. And your poly and your asterisk both going to be hanging out of them. Just boom. Just no fun. And then just went right back to reading.
And he had a way of keeping you grounded, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He was an old master sergeant. Well, my brother Ron, that we talked about earlier, was wound up a 2-star general in the Air Force. Did not go to the academy, which is... it's unheard of to be a 2-star general, probably, if you don't go through the academy. But anyway, Dad was an old master sergeant. Whenever Ron came home, Ron lost a whole lot of rank because Dad was, it's like your dad's house, you know. Those guys, it was their house. But anyway, he had a way of keeping us grounded, and he had been kind of passed around as a young man. And he wanted us to have a stable, loving home. And he and my mother promoted that. But I was playing high school baseball. And, you know, I was probably a little bit full of myself. And it was close to game time. And I was looking around. I couldn't find my sliding shorts. I said, Mom, where's my sliding shorts at? She said, well, they're in the washer. They're not quite ready yet. And I went on some – I said, well, they need to be ready. It's time to play. And Dad was sitting there reading as usual. He looked up and he said, son, two things. One, don't you ever speak to your mother in that tone again. And two, don't worry about your sliding shorts. If you ever get on base again, we'll bring the damn things out there to you. So, just in a few words.
And how old would you have been when he says that to you?
I was probably 15, 16. Just in a few words, he told me, respect your mother and get over yourself. So, it was a good lesson.
Sports always a part of your life, Bino?
Always. Always, whether it was watching my brothers play high school or... playing, I was always playing something, Tony, and I haven't changed today. I don't care what setting I was in. Yeah. What I really wanted to do was go out and play. Whether I was at home, whether I was in school, whether I was at work, what I really wanted to do was go out and play. I got cut in basketball in the eighth, ninth, 10th grade, and, you know, I thought it was everybody else's fault until I realized three different coaches had cut me, so it probably was my lack of ability.
You know, I got cut myself. I look back on that in my life, and I think it's one of the better things that ever happened to me. At the time, it was earth-shattering and the world's ending. I'm almost glad that I experienced that as a kid. What did you, when you look back on being cut, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that it made me work harder at what I eventually got to play a little bit. And you know, I wasn't going to play much basketball anyway if it wasn't in the church league. So I actually got sent a place where I could play. So that was good. I played football 2 years in the boys' club and then played JV at Oak Ridge High School. and they offered me an opportunity to play on the varsity. But I knew in order to get any playing time whatsoever, I would have to pretty much dedicate all my time to football. And I knew once the grass got cut that I was going to want to play baseball. So I never played after my sophomore year in high school, but did play baseball all 3 years. And then went and played 1 year at Cleveland State in junior college. But baseball's the thing that I love, the thing that I was more natural at. And I was, in high school especially, I was a little too small and not quite fast enough at that time to be very good at other sports. But baseball fit me.
You look at home on a baseball diamond. I didn't tell you that. I don't want to blow you up. But I saw you at one of our events that we were doing, W. Lynn's event for his late great wife, Ellen. And you look at home on a baseball diamond. Let me throw something at you. So the late, great Paisan, you've often told me in the past, Bino, you say you are a magnet for morons, which I know is a line that you've borrowed from your brother. And your brother, Freddie, may have been talking about the late, great Paisan. And we when we say moron, we mean that as a term of endearment. We're not besmirching the guy's intelligence. We're just talking about the fact that that guy was just flat out nuts. Tell me about Paisan, growing up with Don Carson, what that whole thing was like. Give me a couple Paisan stories.
Well, I was on the Paisan ride for almost 50 years, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Now, I do look back and wish that some of his older siblings would have told me that it didn't have any brakes from the time that I got on it until Don and I went to junior high school together. We went to high school together. We played high school baseball together. We went to Cleveland State 1 year together. We came back and worked at Y-12 together. We played softball together. I worked for him with the operating engineers for 7 years. We were getting ready to retire together when, unfortunately, Don passed early. One quick thing, the only thing that I ever found that I was going to be better at than Don was retirement. I had just retired into 2015, early 2016. Every morning at 7 o'clock, my phone would ring. And I'd pick it up, and it'd be Don. I'd say, Don, what the hell are you doing calling me? I'm trying to retire here, 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, well, I go to bed every night after Andy Griffin goes off, mispronounced it on purpose, knowing that that drive me crazy. And I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I'm giving you 3 hours before I call you. I said, listen, if you're getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you need to go back. You need to go work at Dunkin' Donuts or get you a paper route or something and quit calling me at 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, well, I can't go work for the Sentinel. I said, why not? He said, because I still owe him $35 from that route I had in 1967. But Don was wide open, start to finish. What you saw was what you got. If he was your best friend, you would never have to worry about a thing in your life. If he was your enemy, you had to worry about that for life, because he was all in.
Tell me a couple of you've told me a couple classic stories through the years, and I'm going to cue you to these because people will love hearing these. Okay. Tell me the story about you guys when you go down to Birmingham and the whole Legion Field story, the mall in Chattanooga. This is a glimpse into the insanity that was Paisan.
I'm going to give you the best Birmingham story. There were several. I'm going to give you a little snippet here leading up. In the years prior to this year that we're going to talk about, Don had done a number of things on Birmingham trips. Once we had gone down there, and I don't know how many federal laws Don broke while we were on this one trip, and this was only like an overnight trip, but one of the things is my Freddie was driving his Oldsmobile Cutlass, and we stopped at a convenience store or something. And Don got back in the store, and he reaches into his pants and starts pulling out some beef jerky. Tony, this piece of beef jerky was about a yard long that somehow he had stolen and stuffed into his britches. And he was pulling, I don't know if you've ever seen the Three Stooges where Curly pulls out that cigar when they give him that last smoke. It's, he started pulling beef jerky out of his britches. It was as long as from that distance that Butch Jones kicked that field goal against Oklahoma or whoever that was. So, and then another year we go down there and he's got this van and he's got Bama Sucks just all over one side painted on it with shoe polish, and he's going about 100 miles an hour down 85 or whatever, 20 or whatever that road is, and he gets pulled over, and the state trooper had a speech impediment, and he comes up to the window and he says, Mr. Carson, he says, he asked for his license and stuff, and when he gets it, he said, Mr. Carson, he said, I've been working this beat for, I don't know, 25 years, and this is one of the most dangerous stretches of highway in the United States of America, and I ain't never seen nobody drive like that. And with this guy talking to the Pison in the window, he says, just a second. Freddie and I are in the back seat, and he turns over his right shoulder and says, have you ever seen a dumber bitch than this right here?
Wow.
And I thought, we are going to jail.
It in front of the cop?
He just turned around his other shoulder. The guy's right there in the window. So, anyway, somehow we didn't go to jail. Well, those are just the lead up to this last one. We go down there in 1993, Former's first year.
And by the Tennessee, way, that's a Vols car, but go ahead.
Tennessee finally looks like they're not intimidated by Alabama. And they've got that 8-point lead, and people in our end zone. Don's in the other end zone because he's not sitting with Freddie and I. He's in the other end zone. He's already made it by because they had a big Mercedes emblem up in that end zone, Legion Field, and Don was a big Union guy, and he was calling them all Krauts and everything else, whatever he could think of to get on them about, sellouts. And so he's already got – but anyway, people in our end zone are holding up those eights with a eight buster posters, circle around the eight because they had beaten us seven times in a row. I told people, please put those down till we stop this last drive. Down Alabama comes, scores. Deuce Palmer goes in for two. They ties. Tie that feels like a loss. So we're leaving out of there. And Don, as was his custom, had imbibed a little bit. And we'd gone on a ride up at Dollywood years before when he was that way. And I've wrestled his keys away from him. He's got a rented Lincoln Town Car, brand new. And I wrestled the keys away from him, and I said, Don, I'm going to drive. And he says, okay. So he gets in the front seat. And he takes both fists, and he rears them back behind his head, and he hits the dash. Bam! Profanity. Bam! More profanity. And then somehow he raises his foot up and kicks the windshield, the front windshield, and just spider webs it. Just crack. And so I'm thinking, I've got to drive in this football traffic with this shattered windshield up here. And Freddie, of course, is in the back seat, and he deadpans. Damn, Juice, what would you have done if we lost? So Don takes that. We get home, and Don takes that rental car back to wherever they got it from. He takes it in there, and he says, yeah, we had some bad luck on the way home. Said a truck threw a rock, busted this window. Guy's looking at it. He says, y'all must have been awful close to that truck. Looks like it threw it from inside the car. Oh, heavens. That was the Pison. Hey, but even going back before that, Tony, 1973, we went to Atlanta. My dad drove us down to Atlanta, myself and Don and another of our buddies, Rebo, who played baseball at the University of Memphis. He drove us down to see a doubleheader between the Braves and the Phillies. Steve Carlton's going to pitch the first game. And we're down there, you know, Dad gets us down there. He's about half out of his mind because he's listened to us yammer all the way down through there. And he says, listen, boys, you guys go do whatever you want to. Just stay away from here for a few minutes. Stay away from the seats for a little while. So we're down there, you know, down beyond the first base dugout, and they're taking batting practice. And Carlton comes walking in from the bullpen. He's through with his early throwing session. If you remember, he won the Cy Young for the Phillies in 72. And 73 was struggling a little bit. Well, I'm 15, Don's 16. Don says, hey, Steve, how about your autograph? And Carlton just kind of looks over there. You know, he just about half looks at us and kind of smirks and keeps walking. Well, Don ain't having none of that. He bellows out, that's all right. I didn't want your damn autograph anyway, you washed up bleep. And Carlton stops. You know, he's about 6'7". So he's just staring at this teenager. And Don says, now that you're done with your warm-ups, you got plenty of time to go down there in the dugout and F yourself. Wow. And I hope Aaron hits a line drive off that big-ass forehead of yours. And Carlton's standing, and I'm scared to death. I'm looking for a place to hide because in those days, Tony, I mean, Carlton was 6'7", did all those martial arts workouts during the office. In those days, he could have come over there and grabbed Don, pulled him on the field, and beat the daylights out of him. And then security would have come down there and grabbed Don, beat the daylights out of him some more, and we'd have been in jail somewhere. But I think Carlton was just so stunned to be getting just absolutely dog-cussed by a teenager.
And he's a guy who didn't care.
No, he didn't care. He just said what he meant.
So the story about, I thought it was on one of those Birmingham trips when you stop at that mall in...
Oh, yeah, it was. It was, and I don't remember which one it was. It may have been the same one he broke the windshield out. We stopped at the mall right there, the big Hamilton Place Mall in Chattanooga. And we were going to go to a steakhouse. It's right there out in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Well, Don just stops there in the parking lot, whips it out, starts taking a leak. And there's a couple coming out of there, and they're arm in arm, you know, walking. And that woman got up close to him, and she went, and I was walking a little bit ahead. She goes, and I heard her say, I don't believe I've ever seen anything like that. And Pison just turned to her and said, I'm quite sure that's right.
Oh, wow. So, Legion Field, you tell one of the great Legion Field stories that I've ever heard, the car parking.
Yeah.
Story. And you told that to me early on as we were getting to know each other. And I thought, this freaking guy is always in the center of the circus.
And it's the truth. I don't know why.
Is this a semi-kayfabe story?
No.
This is real?
This is 100% true.
Okay.
100% true. We parked down close to Legion Field. And anyone that went down there in those years knows that in that neighborhood, it was a cottage industry. You know, they park cars, they boil peanuts, hot dogs, barbecue.
Offer protection. They offer insurance on your car.
Insurance, absolutely. You pay your money or you take your chances.
What is that again? Say
you pay your money or you take your chances.
And that's what the kids told you?
That's what everyone knew, that was the rule down there. So anyway, we pulled up and backed in, and we're always there real early and got some lawn chairs out. There was a young man. He had a red handkerchief, and he's snapping it, and he's parking cars in this fenced-in yard. And so he's parking them, you know, just as quick as he can, taking $20 a pop or whatever. I always liked to go in the stadium a little bit earlier than Freddie did, so I left and went in the stadium. Well, Freddie came in the stadium, and he's laughing. And I said, what's funny? He said, you would not believe. He said, you remember the young man parking the cars? I said, sure. He said, just as soon as he wedged the last possible car that he could get into that yard, he said he took off with a fistful of money. He looked like Willie Gault. Just, choo, and he was gone. Mike said, it wasn't 10 minutes later, a cab pulled out. And a great big woman got out, and the cab left, and she put her hands on her hips and looked at her yard. And he said, she started cussing and said, that little bleep done parked my yard full of cars again. It wasn't in his yard. He didn't have any permission, nothing. He made him some money that day.
And Legion Field, for those not familiar with it, that was just a different deal, wasn't it? I mean, yeah, altogether.
Yeah, it really was. And for a large period of my fanhood, Tennessee played down there every year. They played Alabama there, or they played Auburn there. Both places expanded their campus stadiums and moved their big games back to campus. But for years and years, Tennessee played in Legion Field every year.
What's your first memory as a kid of Tennessee football?
My very first memory is listening on the radio with my dad, mom and dad. Dad loved to listen on the radio. And, of course, dad would get mad at him. Dad would have been a fantastic sports show caller because he was no-nonsense before no-nonsense was popular. He'd get mad at him. He'd stomp off back in the back. That's through. I'm done with that. He'd stomp off back in the back room, and Mama and I'd stay in there listening to it, and then I'd kind of sneak back a little bit, and I'd see him standing in the hallway back there out of sight still listening to it. So he couldn't get away from it either. But that's my first memory. But what really hooked me was my brother Ron took me to the 1965 Tennessee and South Carolina football game played in Knoxville. Ron was a freshman at UT. He was in Phi Delta Theta at that time. We went to the Phi Delta house and watched George of the Jungle. And we went to the football game, and it was just something that, you know, it's like walking into a major league ballpark for the first time, seeing how green the grass is and how, you know, how big the stadium was at that time. And I was just hooked from that point. I often told Ron and Mike was, of course, a big part of my being a Tennessee fan too, but I've often told Ron that I don't know, you know, on certain days I want to hug him, certain days I want to strangle him to death for getting me involved in this. But
when you were a kid, what was the one painful, like, I can remember as a kid, we had a thing called in Philadelphia in 1977 called Black Friday. And it's just forever, like, burned in my sports soul what happened that day. Is there anything like that around Tennessee that sort of meets that description for you? Maybe your first real painful, once you signed up for this, I cannot believe this just happened, memory.
Probably, and I'm trying to think, Tony, what, I'll have to think for a second.
Yeah, that's
what
fine.
The year was. It was a missed field goal year against Alabama. Let's see, we play Alabama here in odd years. This was probably, is that correct?
Yeah.
No, we play Alabama here in even years. So it was, I believe it was 1966.
Was it the Gary Wide Wright game?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
W Wright?
It was. And that one was really painful. I had just, you know, 65 was my real year when I can remember Tennessee football vividly from that point on. And I was hooked at that point. And that was already, I knew how much Alabama meant. And that was really painful. And there's a good story surrounding that, too. Mike was actually at the game. And he said, at that time, there was just two sets of bleachers in the north end zone, a straight set and a diagonal set, and then the hill up behind it with the cannon. And everyone, a lot of people would sit up on that hill. Well, it was raining that day, and Mike told me that he came out of the north end zone, and there was a Alabama fan on the side of that hill hollering, "We told you the tide was going to roll today, and nothing sucks like a big orange," and just, you know, just kept taunting. Mike walked around the back part of the stadium and decided, well, I'm going to go in another direction, and turned around and came back. Probably hadn't been gone 5 minutes. When he got back to that end of the stadium, someone had knocked that guy out, and he was just laying there on that bank up there with it raining on him.
I miss those times, man. I know we sound like a couple of old men, but there was so much soul and so much danger in a sporting event back then.
Yeah.
But people policed themselves.
Yeah.
You need to police. You policed yourself in that era. Paisan, I would imagine, a young Paisan, must have been very interesting against that backdrop. Any memorable fights, fisticuffs, arguments, altercations with fans as a kid you saw him get into?
Not as much as later on in Don's union work. You know, there was a lot of fights in that type of stuff. And, I mean, Don was an older guy. Half of those, I wasn't involved with a lot of that, so I don't know. I think most of his fights came that. And Don was a bull. You know, he there probably weren't a lot of people that wanted a whole lot of that. But he was, after, he was an older guy. And when he came back to Y-12 from his work with the National Labor Council and the International Union, and he was still doing some local union stuff, and he was cooking for a football game, for an Oak Ridge High School football game. And he said, "Hey, I got to leave for a few minutes to go down to this labor meeting, and I'll be back, this union meeting." And he came back and had blood all over his shirt. Wasn't his blood, that blood all over his shirt. And the people that were cooking up there said, "What in the world happened?" He said, "Oh, well, nothing. We just had a little disagreement down to union hall." So he'd whip somebody down there and just turn around and come back and started cooking again up there at Blankenship Field.
I mean, when we say the guy like that didn't care, he's like almost the polar opposite of you in a lot of ways, isn't he?
Well, we were a lot of like in certain ways, but Dom was Don was, I'll go around the block to stay away from a conflict. Don never shied away from him. He never sought him, but he never shied away from him either. So
that's how we're similar. We're both kind of peacemakers.
Yeah, I'll go around. I just don't. I've never seen anything good come out of grown men fighting. I've just never seen any good come out of
it. But I've seen you snap on some people, and you're not afraid to blow up when the time comes, and that's another thing I'll do. And I can lose my way quickly. I want to ask you about a couple more characters in your life, because you've told me some stories about, and I don't want to get this committed to tape here, because this gentleman deserves his spot. Tell me about the guy in Oak Ridge that they call Heavy.
Oh, Heavy Burger. Heavy was a buddy of my brother Mike's. And Mike, back in the day, Mike, and he hasn't in years and years, he just decided one day it wasn't for him and he quit. But back in the day, Mike could drink as much beer as any man I've ever seen. I saw him drink 35 tall boys and still standing up coaching third base at a state softball tournament back in the early 80s. He had drank 35 tall boys in a little less than a day. And he was still coaching third base and doing it pretty well. But anyway, he there were some bars that he frequented. And Heavy was a retired guy that frequented one of the bars that that my brother Mike went to. And the first time I ever met Heavy, this is what kind of guy he was. First, I'd never met him. And he couldn't remember anybody. He called everybody Heavy, so that's what they called him. He couldn't remember anybody's name, so he just referred to everybody as Heavy. Well, Mike took me up to his house. It was around Christmas time. And we walk in, and Mike was going to take him a little Christmas present. Mike took good care of Heavy. So we walk in there, and Mike says, Heavy, it's my brother Jeff. And Heavy said, little Heavy, how you doing? Sit down here. I got something to show you. I mean, I just met the guy. I got something to show you. He reaches in his drawer, and he pulls out this Santa Claus. And he winds it up, and he puts it on the table, and it starts dancing around. Here comes Santa Claus. Here comes Santa Claus. And all of a sudden, Santa's pants open up, and this appendage comes out. And he's dancing around with a Woody, basically, to Here Comes Santa Claus. So that's within the first couple of minutes that I met Heavy. But Heavy was love to gamble. Love to gamble. draw a Social Security check or whatever, love to gamble. But he wasn't any good at it. Mike would help him. Mike was working swing shift, and he'd help him. But one of the Heavy stories was Mike came off midnights and went to the bar. And there's Heavy. It was a Monday. Everybody's coming up. Heavy, you owe me $10. Heavy, you owe me $20. Heavy, you owe me $30. He's just paying them out. Mike said, Heavy Burger, who are all these people, and why are you paying them? He said, well, apparently I lost bets to them. Mike said, apparently? You mean you don't know? He said, well, no, not really. He said, well, listen, I want you to get a book, and everybody that you make a bet with, I want you to write down who you bet on and how much you bet and who you bet against. He said, and don't pay anybody till I come back the next time, and we'll take care of everything. Heavy says, I'm going to do it. 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, whenever Mike came off the next swing shift, he comes in there. There's Heavy. He's paying this guy. He's paying that guy. Mike said, Heavy, I thought I told you to get a book and write down every bet you make. Heavy patted his shirt pocket. I got it. I got it right here, Heavy. Well, let me see it. Mike pulled it out, opened it up, said, bet $20 on Alabama with Heavy. Bet $25 on Colorado with Heavy. Bet $50 on Green Bay with Heavy. Mike said, who are these people? He said, oh, Heavy, I don't know their names. He had written down Heavy beside everybody's name. So.
And these are real. That's a real story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This guy was as real. I couldn't make it up. I couldn't make it up. He called a local bookie on a Friday night. What's the line on Oak Ridge? The bookie says, Heavy, there aren't any lines on high school football games. He said, well, dang, I was wanting to bet on Wildcats. And the bookie says, well, Heavy, I mean, if you want to make a bet, I'll make you up a line. Said, Oak Ridge is an 18.5 point favorite. Heavy said, okay, give me 50 on Oak Ridge. The bookie later told Mike that about an hour later the phone rang, and he picked it up, and it was Heavy wanting to know if the line had moved any. He's the only guy in America that had a bet on the game. Oh, Lordy.
And these are real people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Roger Clemens started the All-Star game. Mike came in the bar one night, and Heavy said, I got him tonight, Heavy Burger. Mike said, what you got? I got a lock. I said, what you got? I bet these guys, Roger Clemens, had pitched four innings. You can only pitch three if you start. He bet basketball. He said, Heavy, we're in good shape tonight. Mike said, well, how come you think so? He said, because I bet every saint on the sheet. I bet St. Peter's, St. Joe's, St. Bonaventure, St. Francis, St. John's, and the Lord ain't going to let all them saints lose.
What in the world? Oh, my gosh. And so you end up at Tennessee.
Yeah.
But you played junior college baseball first.
Yep.
But you, when you went to Tennessee, you scared a roommate.
Oh, yeah, yeah. First, Tony, I left after 1 year at Cleveland State. It's the only – and, of course, it wasn't my plan. It was obviously God's plan, but – I wanted to finish up the University of Tennessee. I knew I wasn't an SEC-caliber baseball player. I'd already missed 1 year of the Ernie and Bernie era. I didn't want to miss any more, so I came back after 1 year. In retrospect, I wished I would have. I really began to pick up some size and speed my freshman year in college. I was a late bloomer, so I wished I had stayed one more year and then gone to Austin Peay, Carson Newman, whatever, played 3 more years of baseball.
You came here to watch sports.
Yeah,
which is the reason a lot of people.
Absolutely. I came here. I came to the University of Tennessee because of Tennessee football of my past and Ernie and Bernie. And that was what, yeah, I told you. Wherever I was, I just wanted to go out and play. That's what I wanted to do. So, anyway, I came back to the University of Tennessee after 1 year. So, what was the.
So, you had a kid.
Oh, yeah.
You scared.
My second year there, I lived in Greve Hall, and in my second year, I made some friends the floor below me rather than the floor that I was on. I had some Oak Ridge guys down there, plus made some acquaintances through them, and they were sports nuts. I was more like the people on the fourth floor rather than the fifth floor, so I moved down the fourth floor, and back in those days, we didn't start, you know, it was three quarters. We didn't start until September. So there were always 1 to 2 football games that were played before school started, before fall semester, not semester, but quarter was in session. So I showed up over there. I believe Tennessee was playing Duke in football that night. I can't remember. But I showed up and moved in early, and I went to the football game. And I came back, and my new roommate was in there. And he looked at me, and he said, "Well, who are you?" And I said, "Well, if this is your room, then I'm your roommate. I'm Jeff Henderson." He said, "You're my roommate." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, then, whose box of albums is that?" I said, "Well, those are mine." Because there weren't any white folks in there. So he was, you know, I don't think he had any issue with it, but he was expecting a black roommate when he came back because of my music taste.
Where did you get that? Where'd you get the black music taste?
Ron was 9 years older than me. Mike was 6 years older than me. So during their high school days, you know, what was really popular was Motown and soul. And that's what they liked. I listened to their music, and I just never, I don't know why, I don't know how, but it spoke to me like no other music ever has, and I just never went away. I've got a real narrow genre of music that I like, and that's it. It's 60s R&B and soul, and 70s R&B and funk, and that's about it. That's about it. That's the way it's always been.
Let's jump ahead because we're visiting with Bino here and we're learning more about Bino. We're learning about his life. At UT, you majored in?
I was a secondary education major, physical education. I intended to teach school and coach baseball. Those were my intentions, teach high school and coach baseball. So I was a PE major. You know, right at the end of my time at UT, PE requirements across the board were all basically cut back, so that limited my teaching opportunities. And besides, once I did my student teaching, I knew I had forgotten something. I wanted to coach baseball, but in order to do it, you had to teach, and I knew for a fact that I could not teach for a living.
Why?
After I did my student teaching, it just wasn't. I found no joy in it. I just found no joy in it. And I knew I would have to teach. I would probably have to teach science or something like that because the PE requirements were cut back. And I tell you, I hated science so bad when I was in school. I just couldn't imagine. I knew when I was up there teaching that there'd be 20 of me out there thinking, "When are we going to get the heck out of here? We got to get out of here." So I knew I couldn't do it.
So you end up working over in Oak Ridge, and your wife is a teacher.
Yep.
She's a legendary athlete. How did you guys meet?
We met the only place that I could meet a woman, which was at a softball tournament. My team was holding a softball tournament in Coalfield. Her team was playing in it, and that's where we met. And it just so happens, you know, I had seen her play in high school. We would finish baseball practice, and that year Oak Ridge had a good team. Otis Howard, one of the best players that ever played at Oak Ridge High School, was on that team. And the district and the region was played in Lenore City, where Marietta was from. So I had seen her play in high school and knew who she was, but I never met her until we were completely out of school. But she was an all-state caliber basketball player, averaged about 35 a game. Went to Tennessee Wesleyan. I mean, went to Hiawassee and then went to Tennessee Wesleyan. She played softball, basketball, and tennis at Hiawassee, and then
that's softball, basketball,
and tennis.
She played three sports. People tell me she's one of the greatest athletes that this area has ever produced, and you've been kind of humble about it through the years, but people on the periphery and people from Lenore City who I've run into through the years have said, you're with Jeff Henderson. They're like, yeah, he's Marietta's wife or Marietta's husband.
Yeah, that's what I am in Lenore City.
No, seriously.
No, that's right.
She's legendary there.
Yeah, she was.
She's legendary there.
She was the first woman inducted into the Sports Hall of Fame at Lenore City High School.
I mean legendary.
Yeah. And she made the Tennessee Wesleyan Sports Hall of Fame as well. You could invent a game tomorrow, and she could play it day after tomorrow. You know, that's not who I am or what I am. There was a couple of things I could do athletically, and that's what I did. So, but, yeah, she's a retired teacher. She coached basketball for most of that, her period teaching. And, yeah, she's well-known. She's well-known down there. She scored like 52 points against Bradley County in a state region finals. You know, her and Liz Hanna was at Bradley County at that time. Really good player. Played at Cleveland State and then went to Middle Tennessee State. But, yeah, Marietta's an outstanding athlete. The only thing – there were only a couple of things that I could beat. I could outrun her. I could out-wrestle her. And I had played a lot of racquetball in college. And Marietta's a fierce competitor. But I could beat her in racquetball. And we were playing racquetball one day, and I was beating her. And I served, and I heard, wha-bam! And the ball hit me right in the back. And I thought, well, she's just mishit that. And I served another, and wha-bam, hit me right in the back again. Well, I thought, well, maybe I need to get the heck out of the way. So I serve again, and she hits me in the back again, and I turn around, and there is fire coming out of her eyes because she just could not stand for me to beat her. And she put three welts on my back, just perfect shots. I thought, well, if you can hit my back like that all the time, how about hitting this front wall a couple of times and scoring some points for you?
I'm in love, Bino. But, you know, there's something about a woman, like, and my wife's sports-minded, there's something about a woman that can sit there and watch a ball game with you and talk some sports with you. And the thing that women do that are sports-minded that I like, and I don't know if you've experienced this, is they cut through the crap. Like, they know who before I do.
Yeah.
They know who's going to get it done here before I do.
Yeah.
And they know who's not going to get it done here. My wife can pick a lemon out almost immediately. Is your wife like that?
She is. I mean, we'll watch a basketball game. And now Marietta's not much of a spectator. As a matter of fact, she quit going to football games with me years ago when she finally realized they were not going to let her play. She was not going to get to play that day. So she's a hunter. You know, when she quit playing ball, she started hunting and fishing, and she likes to be a participant. But she will. She does, as she's getting older, she watches more games with me. But she can watch a basketball game, and she sees things I'll never see because she was a former basketball coach. And she'll say, what do you watch? And I say, well, I watch the ball because they're not going to score without that, and I really don't care what happens otherwise. But she gets on me about that. But yeah, she's not emotionally tied to it
right
the way I am, so she sees clearer than I do.
It's like a different deal when you watch with a woman that's sports minded.
Yeah.
They just have a way, they have a perception, a way of cutting through the clutter. Bino, I was trying to think about this. We were preparing for this today. And generally, I'm pretty good with stuff like this. When was the first time we met? Do you remember?
I do. I came to the WQBB studios. It was after I started. I started calling you, Tony, in the spring of 1995. Small Mike, whatever his name was, I think he was still Jim from Morristown at that time, had called and got on Tennessee about some game they were going to play that year in the 95 season, one of the headliner non-conference games. And I called to say that I thought that it was a good thing that Tennessee was one of the few teams in the league that was willing to step out other than just a natural rival and play a good, solid non-conference opponent. I didn't want that to stop. So that was what my first call was about, and that was in the spring of 1995. And you were so good to me and made me feel so comfortable. And that was my first call. Like I told you, I didn't want to call. I didn't think I needed to call or had anything worthwhile to say. You made me feel like that I did have something worthwhile to say. And I don't know if I've ever told you that, but I appreciate that, and that's the reason that I was a constant caller after that and kind of led to what we do here, because we always had a good rapport on the air as caller and host. But so it was sometime after that. It was probably the summer of 95. I walked into WQBB Studios. It was down on Clinch, somewhere down in there close to UT campus, and I was over there doing something. So I thought, I think I'll go over and introduce myself to Tony. And that's the first time that we met. Was you walked in, you were actually going to lunch, and I waited around. And now, after seeing, you know, I've always told you I thought you were too approachable. And after seeing how kind of people like to be a part of what you do, I guess you thought, oh, no, here's an – who is this and what do they want? But you were real good to me that day too. So,
and you know what's funny about you, one of my lasting memories, and I thought it was one of the first times we had really been around each other, because our relationship was one that didn't kind of take off right away.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is, but I specifically remember seeing you and Fab Five Freddy. It's a year later. This is September of that year. We're at the Florida game in 96. I had my brother Richard with me. And I promised him, here I am a couple years into my career here, about 2 years in. And he said, I want to come to that Florida game. It's game of the century, you know. And I said, oh, I'll be able to get us tickets, no problem. And back then I had Brant Packer, was Billy Packer's son.
Yeah,
was
I remember that, Pac-Man.
Pac-Man. Pac-Man had a whole stack of tickets from CBS. And he was going to bring them to me the night before. And I had a whole bunch of people that I was bringing to the Tennessee game. And my brother was one of them, me and him. So I didn't even bother getting tickets that week. And he calls me up and he says, hey, bad news. Vice President for Sports is flying in with his family. He's taking all the tickets.
Oh.
So we ended up down there. We went outside the stadium before the game in the rain trying to buy tickets. And they were way too steep. We walked in there on you and Fab Five Freddy at the lounge in there. Do you remember that?
The Down Under.
The Down Under.
In the
great memory.
I sure do. It was called the Down Under in the Student Center. We used to go down there and watch games on television. That was before they opened the part upstairs with the big theater.
But, and it was one of those horrendous big screen TVs that, looking back on it, you couldn't see anything on. But back then, that thing was the absolute jam.
I remember that. I sure do remember that. You and I actually had an earlier encounter than that, I believe. A little bit later that year, you were at BW3's.
Wow.
In the old city. And at that time, remotes weren't – you didn't do a lot of – nobody did a lot of remotes.
No.
So that was a big deal, you know. And I came over there, and Big Ten was a caller of yours. And
I had
the two conferences lined up to where – showing that – the SEC would win like 8 out of 10 games if they played, if they lined them up straight. But that's the day that I met Jeff Brock there. I met Phil Cooper there. But that was the first remote I ever came to of yours.